Hey guys, how's it going?
Hey. It's another wet day. Every day that we come to the park is a wet day.
I know, it's disgusting. I did not wear the right shoes for this.
I see that. I know that is really, really muddy. I know it was a snow yesterday. Was it snow yesterday?
Yeah, it's all melting and like, ugh. It's real gray out. But at least we'll get to walk around the park and you guys can get a sense for what it's kind of like here. I want to show you this monument that we talked about. It's just like up the path and into the woods a little ways.
So this is Lucy?
Yes. Yeah, so this is a monument of Lucy Lederer. I have come across this when I come to this park and when I walk my dog. I come here, I don't know, like once a week or something, and this sculpture always captured my imagination because it's really unlike other monuments that I've seen before. It's so little. It's this tiny little sculpture of this woman, and it's so rare to see an elderly woman portrayed in sort of this monument form. And then the thing that I really particularly love about this monument is that somebody comes and dresses it up in different clothes. And every time I come, it's got some jewelry or accessory on that wasn't there the last time I was there.
So it's kind of like a public space that the public actually can interact with, or a public monument that the public can actually interact with.
Yeah, and I don't know who it is or why they're doing this. I mean, I don't think the monument's here to be interacted with, but somebody or a group of people have clearly decided to make a project out of, you know, enlivening this in some way.
Well, and it seems like intentionally or not, whether it's supposed to be interacted with, there's like certain like decisions made with the monument that make it less monumental than a monument usually is, that like invites those kinds of interactions. And I was actually looking up stuff on Lucy and kind of in relation to this idea of land and access and property. Like, she was actually a property mogul here in State College and an art teacher. And she and her son Eugene donated the land for this park in 1986, and it was dedicated to her name in 1991 when the park was opened, which is the year of her death. And this sculpture, at least if the signature on the bottom if I'm reading it right, was made by her son Eugene Jr. in 96, though I never found any record of him being an artist, but I guess having an artist and teacher parent, like, he had some experience or some practice with this. But yeah, so just thinking about the fact that like this was a settler resident of the State College area who she and her husband, also named Eugene, are responsible for the whole like the Highlands neighborhood that's kind of adjacent to this park, and then the park land itself is all like, it's public property as a result of it once being private property that was under the control of this person. And now, like, now that it's public, her person is kind of accessible to the public in this way as well.
So interesting that the combination of her identities as an artist, an art teacher, and us as Sung, you're not an education student, but who are our educators, and we're thinking about education. And then this other part of her that is this kind of colonizing entity in this area, and how that feels so like counter to how I think of somebody who would be an art teacher. It just shows how complicated these issues really are. Mm-hmm. Well, at one point I thought maybe we would focus on this monument for our intervention, but I feel like there's a lot of fodder here, but it's almost kind of overwhelming to engage with this piece because there are so many different ways to read it, from like a feminist standpoint, from like the way we look at monuments. So I think maybe it'd be good to like walk around the rest of the park and see what other things like we might come across that could be interesting.
And I think I was just wondering, it is kind of interesting. Let's try not to set the monument as the starting point to our walking, and it'll be kind of interesting to think about the starting point in very different ways, even though we start from talking about this monument, but it'll be kind of interesting how our conversation might expand as we walk in this land. Just wanted to say that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Well, so some of the things, because I've spent some time here just kind of walking around, you know, there's this like big open field ahead of us here in the park. And I've noticed that there are these little, I guess, placards at the base of all of these trees. And since we're thinking about land and ownership and property and these different things, it's kind of interesting that these plaques seem to be like marking who owns or who is responsible for these trees being in this park.
Well, and within the context of sort of land pedagogy and settler colonialism too, like I'm noticing every single name on these placards is a settler name. You know, both the people who are donating the trees and the people that they're dedicated to, they're all European names, which is adds an extra wrinkle to what you were saying about these serving kind of as like labels of ownership, because the people claiming ownership of these trees come from the same kind of culture that also claimed ownership of this land despite not being its initial custodians, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, how do you own a tree, or how do you donate a tree? I don't know, what does it mean to own that tree? It's going to do its own thing regardless of if you own it or not. Luke, didn't you do some research about the original people who lived on this land?
Yeah, according to the indigenous mapping of the like pre-Columbian, pre-settler North American continent, the folks that were living here before the settlers came were primarily the Susquehannock tribes. And they have very few contemporary members of that community, except for perhaps representatives in adjacent communities, because the Susquehannock were actually more or less exterminated before the United States even existed. In what was called the Conestoga Massacre, there's a community just outside of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, called Conestoga, where the last maybe 200 of the Susquehannock people lived, and they had dwindled by like the mid 1700s to just about 20, at which point they were massacred, children, elderly people, the whole community, by this white racist nationalist group called the Paxton Boys, who thought they were enacting revenge for Pontiac's Rebellion out in the West, even though Pontiac's Rebellion had no affiliation with the Susquehannock or Conestoga people at all. So yeah, there's these individuals that were eradicated, right? This act of genocide was done in a very concrete way, and is documented also in like settler records of the area too. Names are listed, ages are listed, and things like that. But none of those names or ages or things are listed on any of these monuments at the base of the trees.
Yeah, I didn't even know that those were the people that lived here before. That's a horrible story.
Well, and it kind of fits within these larger kind of patterns that we're noticing of kind of like entitlement to land as exhibited by settlers or in more contemporary ways, not just members of like settler culture, but folks of a certain class and things like that. Like I know you, when you were walking Bowie here, have talked about some of the ways that people and their dogs and themselves feel entitled to the land, or other things about the surrounding communities have kind of come up in our discussions or looking things up that have kind of spoken to that too.
Yeah, it's definitely, just in my observations, it's this park is used by a very privileged group of people, myself included in that. From what I've just noticed by walking around the area, the surrounding neighborhoods are all some of the nicer houses I've seen in State College. A lot of like new construction, large homes, pretty much are the periphery of the park, except for the country club, which is on one side of it as well. So it's like on three sides, pretty much surrounded by upper middle class or very wealthy people. And then this country club, which I don't really know much about, but there's a big old fence that separates it from the park. Another thing that I've noticed and is a pet peeve of mine personally is that people are constantly letting their dogs off leash here, which is something that I, even though I have a dog, is something I really don't like when people do. A lot of times the dogs will run up to you and you don't know if they are friendly or not, and they'll jump on you potentially. making you very muddy and things like that.
That's literally a pet peeve.
Exactly. Well put.
It's kind of like interesting to me to think about those animals in the, well, there must be some animals in the park, right? But then it's kind of interesting what kind of animal is considered as pet and what kind of animal is considered as like wild animals. And I am, while we were walking in the park, I was wondering about kind of the narrative that can possibly come up from this place, and come up from this land. What kind of narrative is really, really familiar with us, while kind of those narratives are not really familiar with us. And the possibilities of creating a narrative based on those, our, I would that based on our those lands. And as Luke, you mentioned, the history aspect of this land is pretty much like very erased in narrative that we cannot even think about in this park, right? Mm-hmm. Does it make sense? I'm kind of like thinking.
Well, are you thinking about like the hidden narratives of the park? I think that's what I'm getting out of it, is like when we go to this place, we're seeing it through a very specific narrative of the privileged settlers who inhabit it, whereas like Luke's story of the history brings out another narrative. And then also thinking about the animals that live there, who have their own like life stories, dramas and tragedies and joys played out in this park that are never like shared or told. And then like that doesn't even take us, that's just the animals, it doesn't even take us to like the rocks and the trees and the land itself, which has like its own story and history that are just kind of hidden through the eyes of most people who use it.
And not only, yeah, absolutely, like hidden narratives, but and I am also wondering about those narratives that we cannot even think about. Mm. Something that we can't, yeah. I mean, like hidden narrative that implies that we can think about it later, or we can figure out, or we can find it out later. But I am kind of wondering about the narratives that we can't even imagine, or we can't even think about now. And I think indigenous knowledge, that is one of the narrative that we can't even think about because we don't really know about it, because they were literally raised in this land. So yeah,
I was gonna say that, yeah, like the only records we have in like the settler record is the records of the last 20 people that were killed, but there's this whole history of these people that are not a living history anymore because those people are no longer living, and as a result, like, those records are not records we have access to. It's just narratives that happened unquestionably that we are just incapable of accessing because of these like crimes or because of this violence.
Yeah, it, I mean, that's the narrative that we can, as you said, like, we can think of it throughout objects or those records, but yeah,
they're lost.
I had something is in my head, but I can't really verbalize it now. Yeah,
that's okay. I mean, it's maybe less hidden than lost, or maybe, I don't know if lost is the right word, but I'm getting kind of the essence of what you're saying. They are, well, they've been cut off.
It kind of reminds me too of that idea, like the narrative of this space as a pre-settler space is lost, or at least inaccessible to us in this contemporary moment. And like the existence of the park as a park space kind of is as a result of a kind of like settler attempt to like recreate the pre-settler space narrative, in a sense. Like it's trying to create a natural space by creating the concept of what is natural and then building a space to conform to that construction. And that kind of like speaks to the fact that this is a space where like animals can play out their narratives, but it also speaks to like what Chelsea is talking about with the people and their dogs, where it's like people feel like, well, now I'm in this like pristine, natural, unmanicured park, and my animal is a natural animal and can't be leashed in this space, they need to run free. And what is maybe not reflected upon is like in that specific way, but in a lot of ways, like enacting those narratives like unreflectively about like how the natural is constructed is really just like perpetuating these constructions of colonialism, or these imposed narratives that we place on places and structures of power that we place on places.
Totally. And also these unmanicured spaces where our animals can, you know, fulfill their natural wild instincts, quote unquote, are extremely manicured and are maintained by people who we don't see. They're doing the labor to maintain them. And, you know, a huge part of this park that we're in, this field, is all grass that's been, like, meticulously maintained. It's, like, not supposed to be here and uses all kinds of resources to, like, sustain itself. Well, not sustain itself, to be sustained by us. So it's, like, our attempt to return to some kind of unmanicured natural place is also highly, you know, curated.
I wonder how even possible it is to, like, access an unmanicured space here. Like, there are, like, thatches of trees, or there's, like, designated paths that you could go off of, but it seems like, at least in some parts of the park, if you start to go off of them, then you just hit the fence for the country club, you know? There's, like, other strictures in place. And just beyond that fence for the country club, I know we saw when we were walking by, there's, like, the tracks for the ATVs that the people that maintain the country club drive.
Yeah.
But they're, like, hidden behind a tree line. So there's, like, a whole nother, like, facet of the idea of this space being cultivated, but the labor of its cultivation being hidden. And that's not even a space that's trying to look natural, but it's just a space that's trying to, like, perpetuate a certain fiction about itself that is more tied into class than to, like, myths of nature, but is similar in a lot of ways. It's like this natural, quote unquote, like, public park space has more in common with the country club space than maybe a lot of folks would want to, like, acknowledge.
Totally. I think that's a really good point. And I think, like, that's partially indicated by the fact that, like, the park is super regulated. Like, I assume that you can't be here after dark. It's probably illegal. You would probably be fined or something. And so, you know, it's not an unruly space that can just be used by people. It's owned and it's maintained and manicured and regulated. It makes me think of, in Cincinnati, there's a park that's right by where I live. And that park is, you know, used by the general public during the day, but at night a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness go to sleep there, and there is sort of this air around the park that it's dangerous because these people are there, and so as a result there's, like, actions to try to keep those people out of there, but then where do those people go? And it's this cycle where, like, I just can't help but think of this park in State College and how you would never see a person experiencing homelessness there, and how that speaks to how the space is regulated and how State College as a whole is regulated and how those people are hidden. Because we know that they're there, but we don't ever see them.
And that kind of ties back to what you were saying about the neighborhoods that surround here in particular. Like, even though we're a bit far away from the campus, which is obviously a highly policed space, we're in a type of residential neighborhood that also tends to be highly policed, in both literally and in terms of just, like, what the aesthetics of the neighborhood or the, like, anything that will affect property values is regulated both, like, formally and informally in a lot of different ways, because, like, the space that we're adjacent to is such a, like, I think, I can't remember, but we were looking up the property values on Zillow for the, like, immediate surroundings and all the houses were, like, $700,000 or something like that, $500,000, like, ridiculously expensive, at least to me. I don't know how much a house is supposed to cost, but that seems preposterously expensive to me.
It is. I mean, it's not unusual, but it's definitely expensive.
It's nobody's starter home.
No, definitely, like, not.
A Zuckerberg.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's a strange tension going on in, like, the perceived, what this space is perceived as by settlers and what it really is. I think one thing I've been thinking about in terms of the readings that we've been having and how they could lay to bear on this project, because I think, like, we've had a lot of really good discussions about all the different things in this park, and there's, like, this park and parks in general, there's so much fodder to, like, look at these concepts through the space, and I almost feel overwhelmed by all the different things that we've brought up because there are so many different directions we could go with it. And I feel like one of the things that I've been interested in is this, like, idea of naming these spaces. And in some of our reading, this idea of naming has come up, and how Indigenous knowledges have a very different relationship with naming and with land I remember in one of our readings, the decolonizing perspectives on place, they talk about how Indigenous people think about themselves as being emergent from place, rather than owning place. They are like a product of place, and Indigenous people come to be as a result of place. And so I'm wondering how that might like impact how we think about these trees that are dedicated to certain people and clearly are sending this message that this park exists because of people versus this idea that we exist because of this place.
I think one thing that that makes me think of in terms of thinking about our intervention in this place and how we might want to attend to like those sorts of like non-Western relationships to places is like if we want to respond to these placards with these names on them, like what the first idea, which like I tell my students is usually your worst idea, that like springs to my mind is like to just replace those names with non-settler names, right? To like maybe turn the whole park into a monument to those 20 people that were murdered in this part of the country, you know, hundreds of years ago. But is that like by making just a placard that has a person's name that's written in the Latin alphabet and is mounted in front of a tree, like is that perpetuating more problems than it's resolving, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's tough because we are very locked into our Western perspective. It's really hard. Well, I should speak for myself. I am very locked into my Western perspective and I have a hard time stepping out of that and subverting the very basic things that we do here with like naming things.
So it's kind of interesting to think about how we can, because that's like think about the land as a property and think about the land, the human first on this land is pretty much like the story of the settler colonial perspective. It'll be kind of interesting to restory or remake the story of that settler colonial, can't even pronounce, settler colonial perspective. It's kind of like re-storytelling about the land throughout the epistemology that you just mentioned, Chelsea mentioned. So it'll be kind of interesting how land-based pedagogy allows us to inquire how indigenous knowledge has been silent or absent in particularly in this land, and particularly because we are coming from a college of education where we are the people who study about education with children or students or people. It will be kind of interesting how we can re-narrate those stories again based on their indigenous perspective, kind of mm-hmm. how we can engage with this living things on the land.
Well, does you were talking about like stories and storying the space and the relationship of silence to that, and all of that makes me think about language. Like, have you thought about if we're restorying or telling new stories about place, what kind of ways do we need to be mindful about the language we use for these stories? Like, are there ways that like language is itself introducing problems to the ways that we think or talk about place or space?
Thank you for mentioning language, because I've been actually thinking about the language itself, because I read a really interesting piece about the language from Tokin Yang, the two preeminent mm-hmm. scholars. They were actually talking about, well, not the scholars, the other indigenous scholars. They were actually talking about those terminology to define what this land is itself is a problematic, such as I can't even think about the example now, but when we think about those science language to indicate those mud or the tree or the life cycle itself, it's highly embedded in the settler colonial knowledge. So I don't know how to restore those tree or those mud or the I'm kind of wondering about the language to engage or invite those relationships between the land and the tree. I don't know, I'm kind of like talking randomly but I just wanted to address that the language terminology to indicate the tree, for instance, is a problematic. Then how we can even think about, I don't know, I'm sorry, I kind of like keep mumbling, but I'm just thinking about, as you mentioned, how the language itself can be problematic to think about the relationship between human and land, and those life on the land.
Go ahead.
No, I was. I think Luke. Go ahead.
Okay. But you were talking about how like the relationship between the tree and the land, and how like maybe that might give us a window into a less Western way to talk about our relationship to the land, right? So like I think one of the things in one of the Tuck and McKenzie writings, they talked about the distinction between like the Western Cartesian "I think, therefore I am" versus a more like indigenous framing of "we are, therefore I am." And so like if you think about the relationship of the tree to the land, like neither of those are thinking entities in the way that like the individual like human liberal subject is a thinking entity, but they're both existing entities. They both are, and that relationship and the larger relationship that we participate in as well is like can be a root of being more so than like the individual mind can be a root of being, at least if we wanted to shift those perspectives. And that can lead to like other ways of storying the space that, and maybe like some of the like the new materialist or post-human stuff can be another Western lens, but a Western lens that gets us closer to some of that, like thinking about the way these trees are communicating with each other via micro-rhizomial networks or things like that, that are completely non-human and non-intelligent in the way that we use the word intelligence or something. Like, they can lead us to new narratives.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for rephrasing what I wanted to say. Yeah, thank you so much. Yes, exactly.
I'm glad I was listening well enough to hear what you wanted to say and not just put my own colonizing white man words in your mouth.
Well, I think you guys are building off of each other in what you're saying. I mean, it's hard to talk about this stuff. I mean, language is one of the most fundamental things, and I think for me, just in my experience in higher education, is understanding how much language frames what is capable of us to think, you know? If we don't have a name or have not yet categorized something or labeled it in a certain way, in my experience as a Western person, we have a hard time conceiving of its existence. And I think that like plays out in a lot of like gender, like discussions about gender and race and all of these things, you know, like these words that we attach to different races, like force people into certain boxes when there's like way more complexity than that in any like person's identity. So I think there's like a lot going on here. It's hard to talk about because it's so, for me, fundamental to how I think, you know, like language is how my brain processes my thoughts. And so it's not just writing down or communicating with others. It's even in my own mind, language limits what I'm able to think.
Yeah, Thank you so much. Yeah, absolutely. So, because I read a very interesting article from Bang and other scholars, those indigenous scholars from Six Nations, and they were talking about the Chicago as a wetland instead of those kind of rephrasing Chicago as a wetland. So by renaming and renaming the Chicago as a wetland, they could expand the school curriculum in a very different ways to learn about the Chicago. So I was kind of like wondering, instead of talking about the park as a park, what kind of like word can we use to think about the park in different ways instead of those like beyond those like human, like kind of like what kind of word allows us to think about the ontological differences in of those living things in on the land. Kind of like more what kind of language allows us to think about the park in different ways in the park, because the park is, frankly speaking, is derived from, I believe, settler colonial perspective of what land should be or what nature should be. So it was my thinking about the language and the indigenous knowledge and ontology or something. Yeah, it was one of the things that I wanted to kind of address.
I think that we're on to something. I think this idea of challenging people who enter this space, this place, to engage with it in a different way that maybe is in contrast to how they normally
interpret the world, be it through language or how they physically move through the space or how they use the space. I feel like everything we've talked about is valid and really interesting, and it's just a very complex, it's like the simple thing of a park is so complex and has so many layers that speak to our reading. So I feel like if there's a way that we can sort of challenge people who come in through small like prompts or questions, we might be able to encapsulate a lot of what we've talked about in a pretty simple project.
Mm-hmm. And that could be a way for us to capitalize on like intervening with these placards, but in a way that isn't just redoing what those placards are already doing to the place. So like maybe rather than placing the new names over the old names, that can be the location for those prompts you were talking about, Chelsea. And we can bring in some of the different disparate threads we've been talking about in these reflections and discussions to kind of address multiple different angles with the piece rather than have to collapse things down into one particular school of thought or one particular perspective or angle on the on place in general, land in general, or the park in general.
Yeah, I think that's a really cool idea. I like the idea of sort of mimicking the visual language of the placards, because they do, they're weighty symbols. You know, if we're thinking about visual culture, the placard itself is weighty, and the sort of text and font and all of that stuff. And so I think it'd be kind of cool to sort of replicate that in some ways, but replace it with these very, these prompting kind of ideas that really are actually kind of in quite contrast with the system that these plaques came from. I think that could be really interesting. So I went to Letterer Park today, and it was pretty interesting. I walked around with my dog, and I noticed a couple of them had blown over. It seemed like just like naturally had kind of rain or wind or something, but several of them had very clearly been turned around deliberately. And actually, as I ended up going around the park, I think pretty much all of them had been turned around. So instead of the plaque hanging off of the front, covering the dedicated name, it had been sort of, I would say, respectfully turned around and hung off the back of the placard. So whoever did it, I assume it was one person that did all of them, was careful not to destroy them in any way, but clearly was making a statement by taking them off of the, uncovering the name that was underneath it. So that was pretty interesting little response kind of intervention. I didn't have very much time, but with the time I had, I turned the ones that I could back around. I think I probably got to about half of them. So it'll be interesting to see if they get turned around again or if they will stay that way. And I'm curious what that person's thought process was, if they were offended, if they are a maintenance worker who that was just their job to do that. I feel like there was enough respect for whatever our project was that they didn't throw them away. And maybe that was them having an understanding that this is a school project. I don't know.
Yeah, I wonder if part of it, another possibility could be like when we were installing the plaques or when we were visiting the park, like we happened upon like that woman, Ruth Kazaz, the local artist who knew Lucy Letterer.
Yes.
And knew a lot of the people on the plaques. And I wonder if she, perhaps being emblematic of the type of people that go to the park, if there are a lot of the types of people that are like, feel that entitlement to the space and feel that like social connection to the types of people that are named on those plaques, if there's a like, if our intentionally disruptive, like the narratives we are intentionally disrupting may have enthusiastic adherents that frequent that space, and they may have like gently wanted to like reclaim that space in some way, or like, or in more sympathetic terms, like make the names of their loved one visible again, who is memorialized in that space, or, you know, something like that too. Like there's lots of agents that work their way through there that could be doing stuff, which makes me think of like non-human agents. Like could there have been a squirrel or something that was just like messing with stuff?
Maybe on a couple of them. There were some that just did seem like naturally blown, and who knows, maybe some animal tried to run away with it and didn't get very far. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, I thought about that too, that woman that we met, and I think because I am so entrenched in my own privilege and things like that, I had moments of fear about if people would be really offended. You know, I thought about, like, if my loved one died and we donated that tree and I came there and that was covered, how I would feel about that, and was feeling sympathetic to how that might make them feel. But also at the end of the day, when we think again through all of our readings and sort of this larger perspective we're trying to take, I don't really feel bad. I just sort of, when I come to my like feelings about it, I worry about those things, but that's just something that's not, it's, I can get over it.
Yeah. I think it seems like a recurring theme in the like indigenous thought that we've been reading is not only acknowledging indigenous narratives, but centering indigenous narratives, and doing that means necessarily decentering settler narratives. And so like that doesn't mean those settler narratives aren't attached to real feelings or don't have some level of validity or things like that, but they're just intentionally and emphatically marginalized in favor of these other priorities that we were trying to emphasize, I guess.
That's really well put. That's a very nice way to say that.
Did you see the email from Mark?
I skimmed it. I didn't get to look at it too closely. Tell me about it.
So, I don't know. Did you see it, Sung?
Yeah, I saw that, and I was really happy that his son was enjoying that my prom, which was about love. Yeah. So I was like, yay! See, I'm early child education.
Oh, of course. Of course.
And I think that spoke to the strength of like the piece being able to travel all these different types of like themes and theories that we were juggling with, because like that meant that we could have placards that were more critical, we could have placards that were more poetic, we could have placards that were more like in like specific in their instruction and things like that. And it seemed like the ones that resonated with Mark's kids were the ones that were like specifically like, here's an activity that you can do to intervene with this space. Like his son was really into the mud. And like the one that you had about like collecting materials and leaving the park with them to like blur those boundaries. Like his daughter, he had that photo of his daughter with just like fistfuls of branches that he wanted to bring in their car.
I love it. And it's cool. It's cool to have an example of people of different ages engaging with it, and how maybe kids are more open to subverting some of those accepted boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, let's leave them out there and we'll just see what happens. So far, sounds we believe good. That 17 have survived and maybe more. All right.
All right.